You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. Actually, guys, there's an update in the old Chomper situation.
Oh,
you guys want to hear a little Chomper update?
I've been waiting on pins and needles. So, this is not boring, by the way. This is exciting.
So they last week, I think you, if you remember right, where we are in this saga is I am currently having, I have temporary Chompers in the front.
Little tiny Chompers.
Little baby nubs.
Little nubs.
As Kevin said. And...
that's your rapper name, by the way.
When they do the whole thing,
Little Nubby,
Rachel would know this. When they do the veneers, they make you bite this.
Yeah. Oh, I hate that stuff. That the like putty or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, it's old.
They don't make it bubblegum flavor once you're an adult.
No, it's nasty.
It's
like clay.
But also it's biting like down when you're clay. Completely numb. It's really hard. You feel
he
like
start choking on stuff.
Yeah. It was really bad. And I had that thing in forever, and he just like left.
Did they locally numb it, or was it a general?
Local.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm thinking about asking for just knock
just
me out.
Just knock me out. Do whatever you want to me.
So anyway, I get a call after our conversation on Monday last week. I get a call somewhere around Thursday or Friday that they have messed up the impression.
Oh.
And
stop.
Then I have to go back.
Got to start the Chomper again.
And here's why that sucks. I didn't even realize this till last night. I was on my way home, and I was thinking, they can't do my temporary Chompers. They have to do my little baby shaved teeth. So when I go back in to get
the veneers
off, they have to take my temporary one, chop them off, and you can just grind them off. So I have to go through that whole thing again. So that they can just get an impression. It pushes out when I get my actual veneers again.
So we're going to have a little nubby for a while.
And you have to hope it doesn't mess up again.
Yeah. It's like, come
on. Well, just do it right, dude. Just hold the mold thing in your mouth. Well, who messed up the mold?
I did my part.
You're the
bite
fighter.
Down.
I did my part.
Bite down with your little nubs.
With your little nubbies.
And we will capture the thing. So I don't know. I don't know what went wrong. It was
you're
horrible.
Just a poor mold chomper.
Your nubs didn't nub in didn't. There.
Anyway, so we'll see if
do you
I actually
get to keep
get...
the mold like when you're done? Could you like bring that into the office?
You could. Yeah,
what would you do?
They give
put
it to
in
you.
A glass
it could be
case.
A giveaway. It could be like for listeners of the
take
podcast.
Home Brandon's
you could take home
mold.
Brandon's nubbies.
Mine was on my grandma's bookshelf for a while, just sitting there. Yeah.
The fifth person to call in and leave a voicemail for us gets your little nubbies.
The 100th episode.
We only have one. We only have one voicemail for the 100th episode. By the way,
so that person's staring down the barrel of a double nubby.
That was such a terrible sentence.
They're getting Brandon's nubbies.
Oh my gosh!
Free speech is a mistake.
Okay, so the question originally was going to be, when was the last time
you were bored?
Last time you were bored.
And as we discussed, nobody can say during first and second service.
Yeah. You're not allowed to say during
like,
the message.
I'm bored once a week, actually, at a consistent time.
Between 11:20 and 11:50.
It's a good question, right? When's the last time you were genuinely bored?
Well, how are we counting genuinely bored?
You know
I'm a
it.
Student.
You know
I'm bored on a pretty regular basis.
But your mind is still engaged.
Hypothetically.
Right? But like genuinely bored and you didn't just grab your phone or whatever to medicate the boredom.
Yeah, let's define boredom like the absence of something to do. Is that what we're going to define?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily. I mean, boredom is...
Or some enjoyment.
Yeah, it's a state of mind. It's not necessarily an activity. It's the domain of being bored, right? Let's see what the old dictionary says.
Boredom, the state
of
being
bored. It's not
going to
help. It says the state of feeling bored. Feeling weary because one is unoccupied or lacks interest in one's current activity.
Okay. So there is
that defines
there is an
Nico
unoccupied.
As a student. lacking interest in what's current activity. Yeah. That can happen as a student. Shoot. Yeah, in certain places.
Yeah, the second one is much more common. I feel like the first one...
Weary because one is unoccupied.
The busier you get, the less time. Like, I feel like I spend my vacations trying to become the first boredom. How do I get to a place where I'm unoccupied?
So it sounds like you would say then that level of boredom is a good thing. Because you're trying to reach it on vacation.
Oh.
That's really interesting, Daddy. Brandon.
Yeah, because things are out of balance.
Yeah. But it's a good state you're trying to reach. Yeah. So would you say boredom's a good thing, Brandon?
Well, I would say, here's the nuance. If I experienced that feeling for 80% of my life, I would seek medical help.
What if, well, yeah, maybe 80%. But I'm trying to think, like, is sleeping a form of boredom?
No.
No way. Sleeping is delicious.
No. Ugh. I don't like the definer of delicious.
Oh, man.
Can anyone think, though, of a recent time you were bored? I think it's a lost practice.
I mean, the easy one is during a lecture a couple of weeks ago. I just could not lock in and tune into the lecture. I was just sitting there bored out of my mind.
Were you on your computer, though, doing something?
I was trying to follow along with the slides. So yeah. I guess I filled the boredom by like putting something in front of my eyes, but it didn't really work.
By putting effort into it. Yeah.
But other than that, I feel like I am terrified of boredom. I actively avoid boredom. And so that's a hard question for me to answer, because aside from that moment where I was forced to not use my phone and try to follow along, I'm always trying to distract myself with whatever comes to mind.
Tell me more about that.
How much do you charge?
I mean, that's kind of the point, though, right? It's like I don't think you're the only one who's terrified of boredom. And I think my point in the conversation around boredom is, why are we terrified with boredom? And is that a good thing? Right? Because I would argue, Nico, that most of us are probably terrified of boredom, which is why now when we have, you know, mobile computing and devices that can entertain us, like we can outsource our mind and our consciousness to something else to fill it, right?
Yeah.
Opposed to sitting in the boredom.
I can avoid every inner thought I've ever had if I go stay on my phone all day and take sleeping pills at night.
Yeah, totally. And like the idea of deep inner change, I think, happens from having space to contemplate, to think back, to process, experience, emotions, all those sorts of things, which I think maybe not has to come through boredom, but you have to reach a state at least where you're borderline into that mode of like boredom, where there's nothing occupying your mind to allow yourself time to process.
I remember when I had like one of my first phones. I think it may be like the Nokia brick phone.
Oh yeah, with Snake. You remember playing Snake?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so good.
That was awesome.
And maybe it was there one before that. I think that was my first phone, but it wasn't something you want to play all the time.
Yeah.
And I remember my friend telling me that wherever he goes, he was telling me this is his way of being on time, that he shows up a half hour early and he carried a Nintendo DS with him. And that way he could just be early and play his game. And I remember thinking, wow, you just have something that you can be on all the time.
That is both responsible and irresponsible at the exact same time.
And then like a couple years later, the iPhone came out. It was like, oh, now we have that for
everything.
Now
we all have that. Yeah.
Beginning of the end.
Yeah.
Beginning of the end.
When you, I'm thinking actually, Kevin, of your, didn't you do like some kind of like a prayer retreat where there was no talking?
Yeah.
No devices.
Yeah.
So where did boredom hit you there?
Yeah. I did that. I'm trying to do an annual silent retreat. Although this year it got bumped for my normal time slot, so I'm still trying to figure that one out. But I did a silent retreat for 2 nights, 3 days, I think it was. Yeah. And it was interesting because it was the whole grounds I was on was silent. And so I left my phone off, left it in the car. I did take like one, I took a Bible, one book, and a journal. And it left me with a lot of time to think. I remember sitting down for the first, it was like right as I got to the monastery I was at, I like unpacked my stuff, And I like sit on the couch, and within like 10 minutes, I'd like watch the sunset. And then it was like, okay, now what do I do? Whoa. And that was like 20 minutes in. I was like, I got like 2 days for this thing. And it was wild, but it did afford a ton. One, there is a like almost like a detox period. And it wasn't, I mean, it was 3 days, 2 nights. So it wasn't like an incredible amount of time, but there was a sort of detox where you just stop reaching for your phone, stop looking to what, you know, kind of put on Netflix or anything like that. Like all of those kind of normal habits you find come to the surface pretty quick. And then it was just like, it's amazing how long 24 hours is when you aren't just distracting yourself. Like there's a lot of space in a day when you don't have those kind of things. And then it was just a ton of, I mean, and I went in with a few journal prompts and stuff that I wanted to pray through and unpack and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it lent itself to a lot of self-reflection. Honestly, self-reflection that's like still at the top of my head. Like it was a rich time, because there was a, I think it's just a deeper connection, right? A deepening in my relationship with the Lord in that way. And it wasn't, you know, I don't want to over-romanticize it. It was really hard and really difficult. And I spent a lot of time sitting on a bench and watching stuff. And a lot of time, like, me looking at my watch, like, is it time for lunch yet? You know, like, tons and tons of that sort of stuff. But it certainly afforded a communion with the Lord in a way that a typical day doesn't, but... It's not like you can do that all the time. Like, it's not even to say that's the goal, if you will. But certainly those kinds of rhythms, like, I mean, tons of boredom. Tons and tons of boredom, too. So, I don't know.
I remember hanging out in a prayer house and having a very similar... My shift was 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I remember just how long 2 hours felt.
Like, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, what am I going to do?
I've prayed all the things I can pray. There's nothing left.
But you're right. Like once you kind of settle in a little bit,
yeah.
And also the idea that you're giving, in that context, you're giving yourself to God. You're saying this time is yours.
Yeah.
And it struck me how little I do that with my schedule to say like, here's just 2 hours.
Yeah.
For you, and it.
Yeah.
It tells me how much I've drifted when I have such a hard time just engaging. You know?
I mean, most of our prayer, right, is one directional. It tends to be, at least I've been always taught, prayer is just a bringing your heart's desires and intercession and what's going on in your own mind and heart and life. And all that is a beautiful, proper expression of prayer. But when all of a sudden you have 24 hours or 48 hours for prayer, it's like clearly, like quickly you realize, oh, this can't be what Paul means when he says pray continually. I certainly don't think Paul means just talk at God forever. Like there's that mode of sitting in the presence of the Lord, which may or may not ever again have a reciprocal like God speaking, but in the same way that, you know, and this is what I was alluding to in the sermon, like the way I can sit with Lindsay, like on our back deck or whatever, and maybe talk, maybe not talk, but just like being in her company is an enriching kind of moment for our relationship. Like the same is true with the Lord. Like there is a just setting it aside saying, God, okay, this is your time. And just waiting on the Lord to either do something or not do something, but that's not necessarily the goal, at least always. I mean, you can take retreats and have specific interests that you want to pursue the Lord on, but other times it is just, Lord, I want to deepen my relationship with you. And really there's, I mean, this was back to the attentiveness series years ago. Now when we talked about, you know, attention is really the language of love, like to give someone attention is communicating love. You can't love your kids quickly. You can't love your spouse quickly, or your roommate or your neighbor, your friend or whatever. It requires attentiveness. And so those are modes where, again, when we give attention to God, it's also us loving God. Whether or not he responds, you know, is beside the point. So.
Good.
Yeah.
You changed the way that I view As the Deer. A song that I've been singing since I was a small child.
I might have ruined that song for a lot of people.
I always just picture this like peaceful deer who's like, I'm a little thirsty.
I'm so thirsty.
And just goes to a little stream, a couple laps of water. Oh.
I was laughing first service though because it's the second deer reference in 2 weeks. of a dying deer.
Oh yeah.
Oh well, that's right.
And I was like, the deer just don't have it well this month.
They're not having a good run at CBC. No.
Yeah, I can imagine that's quite the illusion drop to go from a happy deer. I just in my mind I see like a transition happen where the happy baby deer turns into this skin and
frail, like
on the teetering verge of death. And tottering towards a dry creek bed,
looking for something.
That's a lot more relatable, though. I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
But yeah, it did shift it in a helpful way, I think.
Well, it's funny. I don't remember the lyrics of that song, and I should have looked them up. But I don't think they go past verse two. Like now
You're
that I think about it,
my friend, and you are. My brother, even though
I don't think that's anywhere in the song. King. You alone are my heart's desire, and I long
you
to worship
alone
you.
Are the real joy giver.
Oh,
yeah, that's like nowhere. Like the psalm, like that song stops at verse two.
Wow,
I mean, verse three is my tears have been my food day and night. Where is your God? I pour out my soul. Why, my soul, are you downcast? Right, like every other verse is lament. It's a beautiful song. It's probably not even necessarily wrong, but it certainly isn't a good representation of Psalm 42.
If you could capture Brandon's look in a sound.
But you said that happy. Like suffering, it was in the context of you saying suffering feels like a waste if happiness is our ultimate
telos, our goal, our vision, or the lens through which we view the world.
Yeah. That maybe you'd elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, and that, you know, this idea, again, that I opened with that line from the Declaration of Independence, that this is our creed, this is our understanding of the world, is that the goal is, the trajectory of life is happiness. And I would argue happiness is just neutral. Like, I don't actually think I think the pursuit of happiness really isn't a bad thing. I think God wants us at times to be happy too. Or maybe it's just indifference, but when you have a world that views that, I think then when you get an inevitable experience of suffering in a broken world, we just view it as waste, as nothing. It's just a detour on the path.
What if the pursuit of happiness comes at the expense of others?
Yeah, I think that's where it runs into problems, right? Like, and that's where it is neutral until it isn't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In the sense of
neutral at face value.
Correct. But you can certainly pursue it in, you know, ways that are not in the way of Jesus and the kingdom of God. Yeah, no doubt. So I think that was part of the point, right, is that we have this viewpoint that suffering is wasted, and yet at the same time, all of us will experience suffering. And so part of that question is one, what could God be doing with suffering? Mm-hmm. Again, I think we've hit ad nauseum that it's not necessarily that God has caused suffering. That's more gray and unknown. I think the reality is, again, in a room that size, people are all over the map on their experience with the Lord at any given Sunday. Mm. And often they're in that Psalm 42 experience. And so if we view suffering simply as waste, I think we're disregarding a lot of the work of God in that moment. And so like for all of those who are in that season, we have to be able to have that dialogue. And I think often at church, we're either not willing or unable to really give voice to like what God might be doing in that season of lament, in that Psalm 42 season. Because I would guess, I mean, you guys, you know, can speak to this as well, but I would guess that I'm not the only one in times of that Psalm 42 moment. Like, what do we do in those moments? If it, you know, it can't just be waste. Like, it just doesn't, that doesn't add up to life experience.
I was talking to a friend about this yesterday. The spiritual maturity, it feels like it comes on faster in times of suffering, generally speaking.
Yeah.
It's because when you're at rock bottom or anywhere close to it, there, and you have like a single strong rope that you can hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Suffering as a waste would, because then what are you left with?
Well, and the irony, right, is I'm thinking of like how often I sit with people who I haven't met and I just say, hey, tell me your story. And almost always it'll start with some cursory, I grew up here and there and this was my kind of basic family story. But it inevitably will hit the moments of suffering in their life. Like those just percolate to the surface as like this is the primary sort of like big moments, hinge moments in my life. And I think if you talk to anyone, you know, further along in the journey and you talk about their maturity and faith, I think most people look at those moments of suffering as like, man, God did a work in those. Like that was a key inflection point in my life where I matured, grew or went the other direction, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of detoured or gave up that faith and left the thing, whatever it is. Like it just, they are key moments in our lives. And so instead of viewing them as simply interruptions, like I think we have to get to that place to recognize that that's a part of the journey of a disciple is as we follow Jesus, we will encounter these things. And that's not, it's not a bad thing. Like in some sense, like it is in the sense that I don't think it's the intention of God for the world, but at the same time, God is using those moments of suffering in ways that if we open ourselves up to that possibility, I think we can endure maybe in a different way or suffer well. Mm-hmm. Not that it's necessarily, I don't necessarily love that phrase, but there's part of that. Like, how do we walk through those seasons with an intentionality and a sensitivity to the Lord?
Yeah. Let's move to Elihu, the forgotten friend.
The forgotten friend, man.
That some things that some people think that this was added later.
Yeah, I don't think they're right, but I do think some think that it's because it comes out of nowhere. You'd never hear about this fourth character until all of a sudden he's speaking, and it's like, whoa, where's this fourth guy coming from? So some scholars would suggest that this was a later edit into the book that was kind of interjected in there, but I don't personally think that's the case. I think it is in there. Again, we're working with myth, right? Like, and so it's poetry, all that sort of stuff. Like, it's a different genre that is kind of weaving in into the storyline. So, but anyway, yeah, in pops old Elihu.
Elihu?
Actually, yeah. Hey-o.
Hey.
He's actually the young one, too. He makes it clear. That's why he was silent. He's letting the elders speak first, but then he pops off.
That's how Nico always starts off conversations with me. Oh, old one. I am not aged like thee.
You
and who so is advanced in years. So I did not deign to speak.
But he comes in and says that Job's problem is self-righteousness.
Yeah.
And I'm expecting you to say, just like everyone else,
yeah,
he gets it wrong. But you actually agree in a sense.
Yeah.
You say that he's right. And I'm just remembering that initial conversation where God says, where God agrees that
he's
upright. Like, it feels like Job is justified in saying, hey, I've done this pretty well. It almost like feels, I don't know, it feels almost cruel.
Yeah.
To me. So help me understand, why do you feel like Elihu is right?
Yeah, and I mean, we're going through the book in 6 weeks, and so there is a skipping on the surface of it as we go through it, opposed to like some depth. But the other friends get some stuff right too. So it isn't just that they're all right or all wrong.
That's right, the half-truths.
The half-truths, right? And I do think Elihu, not that we're on a grading system, but I think he does get a little bit more right than maybe others, but he still suffers from the fundamental flaw of the retribution principle. And so there's still like an underlying issue that covers kind of his whole argument. But his point is essentially that, Job, you've gone from making your case to now accusing God of injustice. And so that is where it crosses that line. And he makes the proper case to say, Job, you assume you have the vantage point of God on this whole thing, but you don't. And so that's a self-righteous kind of act in which he's claiming to have the same knowledge or vantage point with God. And part of the reason I think he's right is because God will more or less say so later when he has his say. I think it's chapter 40. I was just looking at it this morning. I think it's verse 8. But he talks about essentially like, who do you think you are that you're making these claims against me but don't have knowledge? And so God seems to back up Elihu's point. But yet at the end, God is also upset with all the friends too and says, you guys are all wrong. And you've all spoken improperly about me. So that's the kind of that half-truth nature of it.
So Elihu was kind of foreshadowing what God was going to say about all of them.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah,
how can the created
understand
what the creator sees?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But he didn't take their camels.
He didn't take their camels. No, he didn't. Yeah, but maybe they didn't have camels. We don't know what they had.
Yeah.
But what Elihu, again, suffers from is he claims Job's self-righteous, but he takes, again, he succumbs to his own, he fails at his own logic. He also assumes he has a broader perspective and suffers from self-righteousness as well by saying, I know what's actually going on, and so therefore, Job, let me tell you not only why you're wrong, but why I'm right. And he takes the exact same posture as Job, and he doesn't seem to see that impact either. So that's ultimately where...
Are you laughing at the circular logic where they could just keep going back and forth?
Yeah. Like,
but you thinking listen, that Job, I think that...
I'm young, you're old, but you're wrong, here's why. But also, I'm right.
Yeah. But I know the whole story, you know? Yeah. And again, just to summarize his argument, Elihu is leaning on the retribution principle, which is, again, the wicked suffer, the righteous prosper, always. And he's doing it not in retrospect, not on sins that have been past committed, which was the argument of the three friends, but he's saying there are future sins in which God is sending suffering so that you avoid future sins.
That was a cool angle.
So it's still built on this idea of suffering is the, you know, the cause because you're going to be wicked sort of thing. So that's why this is here. And so that, again, this is where it gets really nuanced, but Elihu, I think, is right in that suffering shapes our character, but wrong that it's built on this retribution or retributive principle, which is what the subtle nuance, where again, he's leaning in the right direction. And that's why I posed that the particular question, and where the sermon really went was the idea of what could God be doing in the midst of suffering, whether or not he's, you know, caused the suffering, what could he be doing within us?
How frustrating for Job, man. Like, you feel like you did pretty well, you're living pretty well. And your friend says, well, it's you're going to sin later.
Yeah.
So that's
all three of your older friends that you've probably known for longer are like, this is because you must have sinned.
He's what like,
did
I
you
really
do?
Did.
Did you do this?
What's that? Isn't there a...
You know you're going to.
No! Isn't that like... Has Brad Pitt that movie where they talk about like... They can intercept crimes in the future, like somehow they get... Adjustment Bureau?
The Minority Report?
Minority Report, yeah.
I think that's where Tom Cruise.
It's what?
I thought that was Tom Cruise.
Was it Tom Cruise? Okay.
The other beautiful man.
Yeah, the other... One of those two. Yeah, but that's the idea. It's similar, right? Like, we could stop crimes before they commit.
Hmm.
Yeah, they could call it the Elihu Report. It wouldn't go as well.
Yeah, I like how you say that any human attempt at theodicy is inherently presumptuous.
Yeah.
And we were talking before we pressed record. Isn't this kind of something that we all are guilty of a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, we all want to... rationalize it, right, and figure out God. Like it's all in pursuit of that question, why, which I think is again a fundamentally human question. And so we all take that vantage point of saying, "Well, no, I see the world clearly, and so let me determine and figure out the why." But God is often less provoked or moved by that question, why, than we are, and that's hard to like. Settle in on and like accept, but the reality is, like, again, any assumption that we make on this is how things are explained or how they're processed, and it isn't to say that you can't speak and try to wrestle with those questions in a humble way, but it's still you have to at least name the fact that God, if God exists, let's just take it at that level, if there isn't a God, chaos is all that matters, right? Like, that's just how the world operates. Nothing has meaning in that sense other than what you create within yourself. Like, and that logic actually is coherent. I think it's wrong, but it's coherent, right? If God doesn't exist, chaos is just what it is. Therefore, let the strong survive and the weak fail, right? If God does exist, then God has to exist on his own terms, meaning he's not contingent on what we think of him, right? If God is a God and not a human creation, he is above all human understanding and logic. And so therefore, by the very nature of the existence of God, we cannot fully understand God. Like, that's just, again, in some ways, simple logic, is to think through, if God exists as he says he does, then of course we're not going to have the full picture. It's akin to, you know, again, like, and this is a scriptural metaphor, but like the pot made of clay trying to tell the potter what's right. You know, but it's like inherently that doesn't make sense, right? Similar to, I think C.S. Lewis used one talking about, what was it? It was like the ant trying to tell a human how the world operates, And it's like, just inherently conflicts. You know, it's the same sort of logic. Like, if God actually exists, by the nature of God being God, we cannot understand God fully.
Yeah, G.K. Chesterton says that we'll go insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you try to, you can peek into the cosmos and try to figure some things out and catch this and that.
Yeah.
But if you try, which many men do,
yeah,
attempt to put the cosmos into your head,
yeah,
then you will, and he gives a lot of examples, like, yeah, you literally just go insane.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the capacity.
There's no way that the human mind can comprehend what it came from, what it's comprised of.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's something I want to say here, and I don't really know exactly what you'll do with this, Kevin, but I feel like we're talking a lot about wrestling with God, and probably that's good because we're coming from the Christian perspective on this. And so, but I think there's a lot of people that get to this point in their spiritual journey where God fails to meet their expectation, or God doesn't deliver on something, or he seems strangely absent or in the face of suffering.
Yeah.
And I think that as opposed to, there's kind of two different directions you can go with it. One, you can wrestle with God when you don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Or two, and I would actually venture to say this is by far the most common, what you said. You just say, you know what? I don't think he was ever there in the first place. I think this was a big, something I just made up in my head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know what I'm asking you to comment on there, but.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, what came to mind was that in times of suffering, I would say you're going to wrestle with a God, regardless of if you would call it a God, right? Like, suffering presents the disruption to the status quo in a way where it questions kind of your ultimate assumptions about the world. And so if your ultimate assumption about the world is God, in the way that we're talking about it, like Yahweh, the God of the Bible, you're going to wrestle with that. If your ultimate assumption is the pursuit of happiness, you're going to wrestle with the pursuit of happiness, which then is in fact your God, right? So like, in some ways it depends on however, like, even if we just take the title God off the table, whatever you hold as ultimate is going to be challenged when suffering comes, which is where, you know, it's a quick move when in kind of a, so in a postmodern world that kind of tries to strip the world of any meta narrative, which actually fails at the same logic of Elihu, because it makes an ultimate statement about how there is no ultimate statements.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it kind of crumbles on its own in that sense, but it's a quick move from that postmodern kind of, there is no ultimate narrative, to nihilism. Like, you can draw this direct line from, if there is no overriding story, then everything's meaningless. And that really descends quickly into a dark view of the world. Because it was Viktor Frankl, right? The Holocaust survivor, who said, like, we're meaning-making machines. Like, we are built for meaning. And I think it was Frankl in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. He talks about how one of the things that he endured, that allowed him to endure Auschwitz, was that he had a meaning. He had a why. And it's, if you have a why to the world, you can endure any how, I think might have been his phrase. I can't remember where I learned that. But we are fundamentally built for meaning. And meaning is going to necessitate some sort of grand overarching narrative beyond the self. And so if you descend into that, I think, it's a quick route to nihilism, which is just, to me, and obviously there are nihilists who stand by that kind of understanding of the world. And it, to me, it's just, it's dark, it's empty. I don't know what you do then with suffering other than it's all meaningless. And it's just the result of, like, this is just the human experience. So therefore I'm going to do whatever I want, kind of thing. It's just, to me, that's a tragic way to live. Whether you want the ultimate to be God, as in Yahweh, which certainly I have found to bring way more coherence to the world and understanding and all that. But you have to have something that is ultimate in your life. It's impossible to not.
Yeah. You said that suffering can lead to greater death or greater life.
Yeah.
And the choice is ours as well for that. And it's like you're saying that we can, you probably wouldn't use these words, and you didn't use these words, but like, God can leverage our suffering for a greater.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A greater good or a greater purpose. But one of those things is that you mentioned specifically around this is that suffering allows us to see ourselves more clearly.
Mm.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think it's similar in that suffering pulls back the veneers and exposes the little nubs. You know what I mean?
Like, yes.
But it
the dirty little nubs.
Little nubs of our life. suffering, like it kind of it forces us to stop playing the games. You know what I mean? It's like there's a way in which we can go through life. It just kind of, and you can even in suffering play the games and all that sort of stuff and never really look at yourself. But maybe a better way to say it is it at least gives the opportunity to expose what's deepest within you, right? It tends to be in those moments of suffering that we find out what our actual convictions are,
yeah.
Which this is a conversation, by the way, I wouldn't ever have with someone who is suffering, just for the record, as far as like pastoral care and how you care for someone. You don't go in there like, well, what you really believe is now exposed. That would be utterly unhelpful and actually
doesn't it feel good?
Yeah, it'd be a dereliction of duty in a lot of ways, you know. And so it isn't in that sense, but I mean it in the sense that you do finally kind of what's inside is then exposed
mm-hmm.
because you just don't have the wherewithal to cover it anymore. And that can be a grace, no matter what's exposed, right? Because until you get to that core of like who you are and what you actually believe, it's hard to really know how to grow in depth with God if we're constantly just covering up and playing the game. I mean, that's the danger of being a professional Christian, right? And that's as far as like being in ministry and pastor and all that thing is you can present and you know the answers, you know the right things to say, you know how to project the image you are, and so you can lose yourself in the process without ever getting down to that core like, no, I'm angry at God. I've got deep questions about God, like that level of honesty with the Lord. And unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, one of the ways God uses these moments in our lives is I think to help us see ourselves more clearly, see our beliefs. You know, in some ways that was week one, when we talked about the retribution principle, or I guess week two, that was my attempt to kind of expose, like we kind of operate in the way that Job's friends view the world. God, I didn't get that parking spot because you're mad at me. Or God, my marriage is falling apart because clearly I haven't been reading my Bible enough, or I didn't do enough, or the opposite. God, I've been doing all these things. Why aren't you repaying me with a good marriage? You know,
and I wonder how much of that is justified by the scale at which we view it. Mm. Like, oh no, it's not. It's not the retributive, whatever principle. Because
yeah,
I didn't get the parking spot. It's more like, oh, this massive thing didn't happen, and that would have been a huge blessing if it did, but it didn't happen probably because I've got this hidden sin mm-hmm. or because mm-hmm. I failed to cultivate this habit. Or if we view blessings as payment for good services, then we might ignore the smaller blessings
mm-hmm.
and wait for these massive ones to come along because, oh, I've been reading my Bible every single day, twice a day for a month. And I pray at every meal and before going to bed, and I've been giving to the poor and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But there's like, I feel like there's ways to, I want to say Americanize the principle.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how well that would stick.
I mean, at its core, the logic is pretty capitalist, right? Mm-hmm. I put in this many amount of hours and I get this amount of pay, which works in economics, maybe. Like it functions, right? It's, but it still falls short because I think what you're getting at, Nico, too, is we have the problem of evil. What do we do with evil in the world? But we also have the problem of good.
Yeah.
Like where's the source of good, right? Which again, that's where the retribution principle really blows up, is when you start thinking through the lens of God saying, you know, the rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous alike.
Yeah. Is the rain tied to? Is the good tied to the evil, or vice versa?
Yeah.
Or are they two separate?
Yeah, which is one of the sort of radical, I don't want to say innovation is the word I'm thinking of, but the radical innovation of Christianity, as far as in the religions of the world, was all religions essentially said the gods are angry and you must appease them. And so therefore make this sacrifice to get in the good graces with the gods so that they will then bless you. And Job's writing in that context, right? Like that's the ancient worldview, which is so retributive. And it's in the same way that we see it more ingrained in us than we'd like to think.
Isn't that like really
ingrained? But hold on, let me finish that thought. Because what Christianity does, though, is ends sacrifice through one sacrifice. Like that's what's so radically profound, is Jesus comes and ends the sacrificial process because he is the ultimate sacrifice. And so to put an end to sacrifice inherently means God is different than what all the other religions had understood about God. God is not up there angry, waiting for us to screw up. Yes, of course, he has an emotional bandwidth in which he does get angry at the world, but it isn't his defining posture towards humanity, which most of us, again, have this latent thing. When we wouldn't name it, like that's what's insidious about it. It's so deep beneath the surface. It's not that we would just say God, like we know better than to say God's mad at me and angry. We use it in kind of clouded, cloaked language. But all of us tend to, I don't want to say all of us, most of us have a view of God that he is angry and he needs to be appeased. It's when I talk to, you know, non-believers or whatnot, and they find out I work at a church, and you watch a whole range of emotions hit them as that happens. But often, like, you'll get that cliche of like, oh, I couldn't step foot on that campus. The God would strike me with a lightning bolt. Like, where's that come from other than?
That's barely, it barely ever happens.
Yeah.
Once a year.
I think I've only seen it a couple times. Yeah.
And one time it was Nico doing a lighting effect.
Yeah, yeah. Nico was causing
it's harmless. It's not real lightning.
But that's that like baseline posture we have towards God. And I really think one of the purposes of Job is to recalibrate that and to really communicate it's not that simple. That's not how God operates. Mm. And he's trying to reset that whole narrative because, again, it is a fundamentally different view of the divine that Christianity presents. Because it's this realization, this exposing of who God is at his core. And he isn't angry, and he's not there waiting to smite us. It's something wholly different.
I mean, you keep saying Christianity, but Job was written before Christianity.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because, so, you know, you're painting this retribution principle as invalid in this conversation, it seems like, because of Jesus' sacrifice. So does that mean before Jesus and a lot of the stuff we see that God, the retribution principle would have been? Like, because there was this whole atonement economy that, you know, approaching the Holy Holies without purifying yourself or whatever.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think two thoughts. The first, we can't, from where we sit, read the Old Testament without reading it through the lens of Jesus. And so just as like a hermeneutical principle, which hermeneutics, the study of interpretation, so how we interpret any text, like from our vantage point, we have to read all of the scriptures through the lens of Jesus because Jesus is, like he does exist, right? And so we can't do that any way differently. Now you're getting into, okay, what is happening within the narrative prior, like in actual time, before Jesus' arrival. And that also, I think, depends a little bit on how you view the lens of God, right? Like, so I think like the vantage point I'm thinking of is Genesis, again, 1-3. God places them in the garden, says, all of this is for you. Do not eat of that tree, right? And gives what seemingly is one command, which the question I often get from people is, well, then why did God even put the tree there to begin with? Right, but I don't think that's the right question because it isn't saying God did this to test them to see if they'd be loyal and then they have to do da da da. But rather, the tree is, it's there, and it's presenting the fundamental problem of, or the issue of humanity is, will we be the arbiter of right and wrong, or will we allow God to do that? So it isn't that God's putting the tree there to test them, even if it is. The testing might be more for Adam and Eve than it is for God. That makes sense. Like it flips that. Like in the same way that for Job, like I don't think God is testing Job. But if we view it through the lens of testing, I think it's exposing kind of like what we just talked about. The test would be for Job, not for God. It isn't God testing them to see like, are you holy enough? It's exposing Job for who he really is, right? It's a, like, in the same way I think that, and I'd want to work this out more, so this is on a podcast, not a sermon, but Abraham, when he's tested by God to sacrifice Isaac, I don't think the test was for God to figure out if Abraham trusted him. I think it's for Abraham to see what's exposed within his heart. Like, we often think of testing as a way to pass the test to get in God's good graces, but what if that whole idea of testing is actually for us to understand where our allegiance lies? That's a wholly different thing that isn't retributive in that sense. And I think that's when in Adam and Eve, when they face that and they're cast from the garden, I don't think that's punishment from God. I think that's a grace of God that in their fallen state, they could have eaten from the tree that would, you know, of everlasting life and lived in a fallen state forever. I think God is protecting them and saying, I will redeem this. This is broken, but I will redeem this. So I think it depends on how we, like sometimes we, in the same way that I'm reading Jesus into the text,
yeah,
we can read with our modern lens of this is what atonement and sacrifice, all that looks like. We can take that into the Old Testament and read that back into it. Oh, God must be angry and therefore
yeah,
this is the system he's set up, which I think is a bit of an improper way to read. It's a good question though. Like a really, and I honestly, it's probably a mediocre answer because I think it's a really good question.
Okay, so you kind of wrapped everything with these three ways to lean into suffering.
Yeah.
All of them are us embracing discomfort,
yeah,
which is not something that we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
So unpack those a little bit. You enter the desert, walk with community, and embrace the mystery of God.
Yeah. So enter the desert, right, is my attempt. Again, one of the metaphors that isn't just mine, but that spiritual formation writers in particular have often talked about these seasons of suffering is through that lens of a desert, which I think is a good one, right? The desert's pretty harsh. It's brutal. It's unrelenting.
Not in Scottsdale.
Oh, yeah, you get...
That's where I just was.
You get enough places with air conditioning, the desert gets real comfy, you know? But it tends to be in that direction. And so I was just leaning into that metaphor and saying, often we try to avoid the desert. We try to drive through it. We try to get by it quickly. But there's something about that season that I think is inevitable. And if we enter it instead of avoid it, I think we can find the beauty within it, right? And often that means slowing down, paying attention to the little things, seeing the beauty of a sunset or sunrise, paying attention to little details as you walk through, you know, seasons like that. So I think that's
succulent.
Part of a little tiny succulent over there, just
that,
thriving.
Like that guy right there on the shelf.
Still thriving.
But there's
only
that
living plant in Brandon's office.
This one's making a comeback though. You got one that
it's trying. This one is in
it's
the
fighting
midst,
for life.
It's in the dark night of the soul right now. It's
a little less crispy than last one. So that's good.
The crispy night of the soul. Yeah.
The slow work of
Brandon, who is its lord.
Yeah. We should take a picture of that plant and put it in the notes so that people
We've mentioned it a few weeks in a row, haven't we?
I'll take a picture and send it to Sandy.
The crispy plant.
So people can visualize the plant.
Yeah. And so then the second, walk with community, is just the recognition that one of the strategies of Hasatan or others is to what's the word I'm looking for?
Isolate.
Thank you. I was like, make someone alone. That was coming to mind. But to isolate people, right? And to assume that you have to walk through that desert alone.
Yeah.
But this is not necessarily, like, there's a little bit of the text where Job talks about the advocate or this angel or someone who's there. But this is a little more just, I think, pastoral advice is don't go through that season alone. It's easy to assume you're the only one. In a room that's singing about like the beauty of God, you often feel isolated. But my hunch tells me you're not alone. There's many in that room that are probably going through that. Or two, whoever's singing, leading, whatever it is, we've been in those seasons. And not that we've mastered them, but man, we can walk alongside you, journey and companion with you through that. So I think that's just an important piece because we often want to just walk it alone. But you don't have to.
I think it's worth mentioning there that that is very, very awkward.
Yeah.
Let's just call it what it, I mean.
Yeah.
Embracing community in the desert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, our small group has been going for a long time and we're finally starting to get to the point where we're willing to be vulnerable with the stuff that's not going well in our lives. It's easier to be vulnerable, particularly if it's stuff that you feel like you had a hand in.
If it's
something that you caused or had a hand in causing or whatever, it's so hard to bring that to other people because it's a risk.
Yeah.
Like doing this in community. So I don't want to just say, yes, live in community, get in a small group, you know, whatever. Like it is a brave, valiant effort yeah. to bring your vulnerability yes. and your brokenness
yeah.
to other human beings. Because they may give you answers like Job's friends give
yeah.
you.
Yeah. yeah. Well, and honestly, like, and this is the part that the church at large has to own is like, we haven't always handled that well. Mm-hmm. We do give cliches. We do mm-hmm. give sentimentality in moments of deep questions. And this is where we should learn both what we shouldn't do from Job's friends and what we should do from Job's friends. There's something that's playing.
Oh, it's
playing
the outro
there.
Music.
Yeah, what's in my headphones?
Sorry. Again, you can clip this part. But so there's things that we should learn from Job's friends and things we shouldn't. Job's friends rightfully entered in and for 7 days spent time in silence with Job, just sat with him. Mm. That's a really healthy posture yeah. that the church often hasn't taken. And particularly as a preacher, I tend to run in with words. It's one of those growth areas. It's like stepping in and just being present. Like, how do we just be present to people? Because you're right, Brandon, like it is just it is a difficult thing to name your pain in community because often we drop the ball on how to handle that. So I think that's smart. But and the third thing, embrace the mystery of God. And again, I named in the sermon, that's such a churchy phrase. But what I was hoping to capture with that is mystery as disorienting. Because I think there is something we learn in Job that God is in fact mysterious in the way that he operates the world. And so we have to embrace that mystery, but it doesn't mean it's less disorienting and that it is in fact like unknown. And the reality is, as I was studying for this Sunday sermon, Job and the reader never find out why Job suffers. Like you never really get an answer. God never explains himself. He doesn't say this is why he did it. So that, you know, because here's the thing. If God had said, you're going to suffer this and endure so that you're known for multiple millennia and your story will be an inspiration for everyone. At that point, is Job suffering to just love God or suffering to get that acclaim? Like if at any point God explained it to Job and said, this is why it was going to happen, it changes the whole dynamic of Job's suffering to where he was essentially earning, it was retributive. I'm earning whatever status would come from that, which is ironic because again, Job's fame and all that, or fortune, all that is restored at the end of, God does in fact restore it for him. Mm. But he never tells Job along the way that it would be restored if you hold up your end of the bargain. That would be a sort of testing like what we talked about. I'm testing to see if you're good enough and then I'll give it all back to you. That's the retribution principle again, right? Which again, we've said is left wanting. So it's the part of the mystery, the frustrating part is you will likely never understand why. Mm. And again, that's not necessarily the way I lead when I'm sitting with someone, but it is kind of, I think, part of the truth of how we understand suffering is we may not have answers. And so you have to learn to embrace the mystery, the disorientation of how God is operating in the world.
One of the discomforts I have with that, and maybe where I was going originally when I brought up people walking away when they hit suffering and saying God isn't real, is those people that have walked away and have decided that God isn't real.
Yeah.
I feel like they look at us saying, well, sometimes you're just not going to understand.
Yeah.
Sort of laying aside your intellect.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Where you're like, really? Like, what other area in life do you just say? I guess I just won't know.
Yeah. 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 And this is the importance of understanding. Like, that's why, like, this Sunday, I'm going to talk about how the invitation is to just trust God. There's a reason that's week 5 of the series. It's a reason that's at chapter 40 of the book of Job. Is because that may be in some ways the right answer, but my goodness, we don't lead with that, like at all, like not without wrestling with these deep questions, coming face to face with the character of God, giving space to lament, to even protest, like, God, this is unjust. Like, I think that even though it later devolves into a self-righteousness for Job, there's a healthiness and a space in which we need to give room to lament and protest and all of those sorts of things. And so certainly it can be a cliche to say, well, you just trust God. But when you put it in the context of wrestling with God for 40 chapters, it's different. It isn't the flippant disregard of emotion and thought. It comes at the end of a God that's leaning in to hear your pain, to listen to your suffering, walking alongside you. And then you get to that place of invitation to trust, which at least to me feels different to have wrestled with God in that.
I also think that the discomfort in not knowing is a pretty modern phenomenon.
Mm. Yeah.
given that we're in like in the middle of the information age with all the good and bad that that brings.
Yeah.
Because when Job was written, or even as early, even as late as 100 years ago, a couple hundred years ago, you had to be comfortable not knowing most things. Or now, if I don't know something, there's a 99% chance that I can look it up on my phone and know. Yeah. And so now the things we can't know eat away at us that much more.
Yeah.
Because I can't discern God's will from my Android.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
No doubt that's a big piece of it.
Bad question before we close. I feel like your voice has gotten lower, Nico.
Mine?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm still sleepy. I don't know.
The deeper the voice, I think the more wise it is. So he's just trying to hit those lower registers.
As I sit next to Kevin, I'm assimilating more and more.